Hello, this is Oye Asabade, editor of halftribe.com, and I'm here with Jude DeBeer, author of Walking with Shadows, his first novel, published in 2005 and shortlisted for the ANA NDDC Ken Saro-Wiwa Prize for Prose in 2006. His second novel, Unbridled, won the 2007 ANA NDDC Ken Saro-Wiwa Prize for Prose and also was a finalist for the Nigerian Prize for Literature 2008, sponsored by the LNG. Hi, Jude.
Good morning, Oye.
How are you doing?
I'm not bad.
Well, it's good to have you on halftribe.com.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So about a month ago at the beginning of July, we got an email and the email read, "Dear editor, I discovered your site recently and was impressed. I'm a novelist resident in Nigeria and would like to contribute a short story to your prose section. I discovered that I could not do this, however, as I am not a member of this site. I would like to know how to submit this story. Kind regards, Jude DeBeer." And that was our first direct communication with Jude. We responded that you had to be registered on halftribe.com to be able to submit articles and that we were looking forward to receiving the article. Several emails back and forth later, we received the article and after reading it, we were in awe. We sent back a note saying we were happy and honored to publish the short story on halftribe.com, and we did that day. In just a few short days, it had generated so many hits and comments, and today the last bill has generated over 500 hits and several comments. At least two print media in Nigeria picked up the story after reading it on halftribe.com.
That's true.
Jude DeBeer has kindly granted us the time out of his short vacation from the fast pace of Lagos, Nigeria, to interview him. We, on behalf of our audience on halftribe.com, would like to get to know who is Jude DeBeer.
Who is Jude DeBeer? That's, I don't know, it's a very tricky question to ask. I always feel that there is two sides to every personality. There's the professional side, which is Jude DeBeer the writer or Jude DeBeer the project manager. And then there's the other part, which my parents call Chukwuma, my other name. So it's, well, you need to ask me a general question, a specific question, and then we can pinpoint which part of Jude DeBeer you really want to know about.
I'm sure we at halftribe.com would like to know both parts, but why don't we start with you just telling us who you are. I'm giving us a short bio of yourself. Let's start from Chukwuma, and then we'll graduate to project manager, and then we'll graduate to the writer.
Okay, well, I was born in the mid-70s and to a family of all boys. I'm second. And I grew up basically in Lagos. And I think my first memory of childhood is the books that, you know, I was surrounded with. My dad had a library at home, so there were always books. And if you needed an escape or anything, you always had books to go to.
Right.
And he was unique in a sense. One of his punishments when you were stubborn or, you know, being, you know, we're all boys and everything, one of the punishments he dished out to us, well, rather than, you know, discipline us, he'll give us a very difficult book to read.
Oh.
And he never allowed you to cheat, which means once he gets back, you know, he'll give you a couple of days, go read this book and you need to summarize it and tell me chapter by chapter what, you know, the story is about. So from an early age, you know, I was introduced to reading and discussing books. And I was reading, you know, writers like Charles Dickens, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Chekhov, and, you know, some basically tough writers to read.
Right.
But, you know, being a very reclusive child, I realized that I was enjoying that. I was enjoying the world that was created, you know, through these books. I was visiting places I could never dream of going to, you know, Russia from the time of, you know, Stalin. I was in England during the period of Dickens, read Shakespeare, you know. Gradually I was transported to American fiction through the Huckleberry Finn. And, you know, it was just really, really strange, but quite interesting. But in my early years, I never encountered African writers, and I was a child of, the city. I was born in the city. I was raised in the city. I had no idea about a village life, an alternative life, but city life. And then I think I was about between 8 and 12 when my dad introduced me to Chinua Achebe. It sounds a bit cliche because almost every writer says, oh, Chinua Achebe, but no, truthfully, he was the first African writer I read.
Right.
His writing really was was like a shock to my system, basically, because he was talking about a world that I ought to know, but I had no idea about.
Right.
And then, I started to ask questions, In my family, we spoke no languages at home except English, and this was a man talking about culture, about customs, and I had no, idea about these things. But it was also quite interesting. From him, I started reading other African writers.
Yes.
And then getting, a sense of jealousy. I was like, if they could tell their stories, why can't I tell stories too? I wanted to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
So in the back of my mind, I always knew that one day, just one day, I will tell stories, I will write a book, So that's how it started for me. And that's how I graduated from Chukuma to Jude. I think Jude was when I got into secondary school,
mm-hmm.
I was mocked tirelessly. I had, I was one of those kids that had an accent, and then a name that didn't go with an accent, Chukuma, and a whole lot of people couldn't pronounce it properly.
Right.
And then there was so much abuse of the name. And then I opted for my other name, which was Jude, and I've been living with that for about 20 years now.
Right, okay. That's actually very interesting, the way you progress. So really, we have your dad to thank for, your writing genesis, if you will.
Yeah, I think so. I believe that I have a lot to be thankful for, to him.
Mm.
That's true.
Does he take the credit? Does he realize he deserves at least the lion's share of the credit?
I think he does. I think he really knows, I valued books more than my older brothers. So
okay.
Even up to today, when I do get to see him once in a while,
mm-hmm.
He's always looking for, have you read this? Have you seen this book? Have you had that book? And anytime I travel, the only thing I can think to get from my dad is a book, So I go out looking for the authors I know he reads and looking if they have anything good, out there, or something probably he hasn't read in a long time, or something that he probably owned at the time that we destroyed as kids, So, yeah, I think he knows.
Oh, that's good. So, you've always wanted to be a writer? Did you want to be anything else, or?
Yes. Growing up in the 80s in Nigeria, it was the prestigious professions like, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a lawyer, an engineer.
Yeah.
And that's the areas your parents pushed you to,
Yes.
And at the time, I thought that I would be a lawyer.
Right.
I thought it was a very, very, very distinguished profession.
Right.
I hated the sciences. I couldn't stand the sight of blood.
Oh.
I hated biology in school. I hated physics. I hated anything that had to do with sciences. So I always thought, okay, law is not such a bad profession.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't like, I sort of, later it dawned on me that the only thing I was actually good at was telling stories.
Okay.
And I started writing. I was writing, a whole lot when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
Every time I got a new exercise book, I said, scribbling down, and my dad would get home, sees that, he goes into a rage that I'm so destructive and blah, blah, blah. And, but kind of, you never can, I couldn't put a name to it. I didn't say, I'm going to be a published writer.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that I wanted to tell stories at a given time.
Okay.
When I got to the university, before I got into the university, I went to art school for 2 years, at College of Technology,
mm-hmm.
and I studied arts. And my parents weren't very supportive of that. They felt that's a useless course to read. But I've always loved drawing and paintings and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was concluding my diploma program, I took the JAM exams and opted to study what was it, communication arts or something like that at the University of Ibadan.
All right.
And as fate would have it, after the whole exams and everything, I met this girl who studied German.
Right.
I met her through a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so impressed because every time she was speaking English, she would just forget the words and switch to German. And
okay.
I was like, goodness, where did you learn German? And she was like, well, it started in school. She, you know, that's what she studied at the university.
Right.
And it was like an epiphany for me. So afterwards, I went to the JAMB office, you know, got the change of course form, filled it out, and I put German. You know, so when the results came out, and my dad was, you know, going to look for, you know, went to the post office to get my, you know, the results and everything.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't tell me anything. So the next day, he was like, well, I have to go back to the JAMB office. And I was like, why? He said, they made a mistake in your admission letter. I said, okay, what mistake? My name, spelling, or whatever. I said, no, nothing like that. But you got admitted for German. You know, and I was like, oh, exactly, that's exactly what I, you know, entered for. And I was expecting him to throw a fit,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't. It was more like, okay, I'm sure you're going to get tired after your first semester and come crying back. You know, but you know what, I studied German in the university and I finished the course
mm-hmm.
in flying colors as well. As soon as I was through with that, I started working with Lufthansa German Airlines,
right.
and after which I moved over to Virgin Atlantic Airways. Now, in the years that I worked actively with Albrighton, I felt a void, you know, this huge void, like something is wrong, something is missing.
Because you were not writing.
It wasn't just right. I just felt so incomplete, if I was to use that word.
Okay.
And I started reading again, and that was when, you know, I picked up works from Elaine Harris and some other writers,
mm-hmm.
and I started searching for literature in Africa that had to do with sexuality, especially male sexuality.
Right.
And I couldn't find any. I was finding, you know, papers and intellectual stuff and studies, but not fiction, nothing like that.
Right.
And I did a small Google search, and I was like, nobody in Nigeria really has tackled this. Yes, Wole Soyinka wrote, you know, about a gay character in The Interpreters. But then again, the character was an American character, not an African character.
Mm-hmm.
And his portrayal of that character was very negative, not positive.
Right.
And I started thinking, why can't we bring this, you know, why can't we have a new perspective on this and somebody should write about this?
Right.
And all the what if questions came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing. It was just like that. I started writing until I had a completed manuscript. And I started searching for a publisher in Nigeria. It was very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people I approached were looking for money, you know.
First off, then
I met a very, very, very helpful and, you know, encouraging publisher, Mukhtar Bakare.
Mm-hmm.
He publishes Farafina magazine and the Katifo Press, which is a big publisher in Nigeria.
Right.
And he read the manuscript and he got back to me and he was like, this is really interesting,
mm-hmm.
you know, really, really good stuff. But he's not sure if he can publish it because of the content,
mm-hmm.
which really surprised me because while writing Walking the Shadows, you know, I made it a point of duty not to dabble into anything graphic or sexual in that sense,
right?
Or rather psychological, because it's a book about questions.
Mm-hmm.
So there were no graphic sex scenes or nothing like that. It was more of questions and how we react to certain issues.
Questions about sexuality?
Sorry? About what?
Questions about one's sexuality, that is.
Exactly.
Right.
And but he did give me a lot of stuff to be encouraged about. And I went on looking. I came to England. I shopped around for an agent, publishers. Wasn't working. Nobody believed in the manuscript at the time. And then I went back home to Nigeria. And, you know, a couple of cousins and friends, you know, got to read the manuscript. And they were like, you know what, we can actually help you with this.
Mm-hmm.
And so they set up a sort of small independent publishing firm. And they were willing to take a risk on my manuscript first.
Wow, okay.
Which was really, really, really risky at the time.
Yeah.
And Walking with Shadows, you know, came into the market in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember before it came out, one of the publishers asked me, one of the editors asked me, you know, you're taking a big risk writing this book. And I said, what's the biggest risk? What do you mean by risk? He says, well, everybody's going to assume that you're gay if you write this. And I was like, okay, and what else? He said, and that's just about it. And I was like, if that's all that's going to be, I can live with that. I can live with the suspicion. It doesn't really bother me that much.
Okay.
And then, you know, the book was released. Little did I know that, you know, it was going to have this effect on our society in Nigeria. A lot of people got to read the book. It's my biggest selling book to date, as funny as it seems. And it never won a single award, but every time I'm in book readings or I'm invited to speak about my writing, everybody focuses on Walking with Shadows. So it tells me something. It tells me something about Africans, about Nigerians, and our curiosity about sexuality, you know. And I'm happy I was able to contribute something to that, and not in a negative, you know, way.
Yeah, you're right. It does tell something about the society that in spite of our supposed conservativeness, there's still a curiosity of the mind, if only, you know, if only to echo the questions you do have in your mind or to, you know, answer some of the questions that are out there that, oh, okay, this is interesting to think about, right? And even though you said it didn't win any award, to be fair, it was shortlisted, you know, in 2006.
Yeah, but the funny part is, I only got into this whole idea of, okay, the award thing and the way it works in Nigeria is it's a very good vehicle to help promote your work. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to really win anything. If it's shortlisted, that means it's been approved or more or less it's been read and given the thumbs up and people feel this is a good read, this is something people should go out there and read. And that's the way I've always looked at all awards, regardless of who wins it. So I wasn't like deterred or anything.
Right.
I just was more determined to write my second novel.
Yeah.
It turned up to be also pretty controversial. And it won an award, which was quite funny.
Yes. No, I mentioned that because you had said it didn't win any award. And I was like, well, it was shortlisted. So even if, you know, whether there were 100 candidates or 1,000, you're still being shortlisted out of a whole group.
Yeah.
So kudos to you for your first novel. I mean, to come out of the bat, it's like being on the Billboard charts, right?
Something like that.
No. Congratulations. That's definitely
thank you.
Happy. So now it begs the question, why the controversial topics? Is it just because people are not talking about this? Or is it because, you know, you have, you're curious about it yourself? Or is it because you have some, you know, closeness to the topics, if you will?
Well, I would say it's a mixture of everything.
Okay.
Well, most importantly is even before I decided to become a published writer, I did do my research, and I was talking to a whole lot of Nigerians who read,
right,
who the types I would travel, the types I would visit bookstores to buy books.
Right.
And one of the things that he kept saying was that, oh, I don't like reading Nigerian novels. Oh, I don't like reading Nigerian novels. And, you know, it's a bit disheartening for a writer to hear that, because your primary audience are the people you live with, which is
absolutely
your locality, which is Nigeria.
Absolutely.
And you can't be a novelist and not have anybody buy your books.
Right.
And the things that they were saying, the answers they were giving were, oh, they're so boring, they're not well, you know, put together, you know, they look cheap. But the most striking was the fact that they said, apart from Achebe and Soyinka, nothing new has been introduced into the market. Every other writer that has come into the scene is almost like a copycat, trying to be an Achebe wannabe or a Soyinka wannabe.
Right.
And they want to read something differently. They want to read something much more contemporary, something that they can relate to.
Right.
And then, you know, and that suited me well, because I just want to read something, you know, totally new, something that will give me insights into issues that I'm either familiar with or curious about.
Right.
And the stories I wanted to tell are stories of people who don't have a voice. And I didn't choose the stories. I think they more or less they chose me. These are stories that just came, and they're like, you must tell us. And if you're a writer, you probably understand what, you know, where I'm coming from. You don't go out of your way to say, I'm going to write about homosexuality. I'm going to write about incest in society. These things might rear their head in your literature, but doesn't mean that you've put your mind out to just write them.
Yes.
I'm more concerned about people, how they react to issues, stories, basically. And that's what, you know, that's what informs my stories, actually. So at the end of the day, I just write what I feel people would want to read, what people can relate to, you know, and things like that.
Okay, that's really good. I think you're right about the comment you made about as a writer, you know, because I've heard that statement about the story choosing you. I think writers do gravitate to certain things. And in a sense, one wonders why, you know, there are not more people writing about various topics, because there's so much to write about.
Well, I think one of the thing is the fear of, you know, going into certain areas. There's that. I can't deny, you know, to you that when my first book came out, yes, a whole lot of people automatically assumed if I was, which was nobody's business, because I really refused to tackle that, you know, issue with the press.
And you shouldn't have to answer that, whether you are or you're not, right?
No, it doesn't really matter, really. But you find that people are too afraid to be labeled as something.
Right.
So you might find some female writers being afraid of, you know, tackling certain subjects because people might look at them and think, oh, maybe she's experienced it. Mm. And I think it's very, you know, funny when people approach me to say, oh, you really captured this moment so well in your book. And did it happen to you?
Right. Okay.
And in one of the interviews that I've been in, and somebody asked, but you have to experience this to write it. And I'm like, that's not necessarily true.
Right.
You know, you don't have to experience anything to write it. People who write about alternate history or who write about fantasy and, you know, the mystical stuff,
right,
they don't have to really experience it. It's all fiction. It's all literature. That's what they do. They tell stories. And that's what even led me to my second novel, Funny As It Seems, because the book is a story about a woman who's gone through a lot of abuse in her life. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the end of the story, she finds her voice. She becomes emancipated from a world dominated by men.
Right.
You know, she'd been through abuse, sexual abuse, mm-hmm. verbal abuse, physical abuse,
wow,
from family members. And, you know, and I remember during the presentation of the book in Nigeria, all the female journalists were asking, what makes you think as a man that you can write authentically as a woman?
Which is a fair question.
Yeah, which was, and I said, you know what, I would answer that question after you read the novel. Then
good
you can
one.
Ask me that question again.
And that's a fair
and,
answer.
And then she writes me 2 weeks later, and, you know, all she could do was give me an ovation on over the email, saying that this was wonderful. Mm-hmm. How I did it, she has no idea how I did it. But my point, why I brought this up, my point is, I wasn't a woman.
Yes.
I didn't have to be a woman to write that experience. All I had to be was human.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you just have to be human and have a little bit of imagination.
Exactly.
And yes, this is true. And if you can feel it, you can do it.
You can do it. But I also learned to, I have to be quite honest, I also learned a lot by writing that story. I learned that women and men are very different people. If a man says yes to something and a woman says yes to the same issue, they're saying yes for different reasons and they're coming at it from different perspectives.
Absolutely.
I understood that male writers and female writers do experience stuff differently and they do express themselves differently as well. And my first draft of Unbridled, which is my second novel, was very different from what people read today as a novel. It was workshopped with other writers, with other female editors. I remember the first time, it was after I'd completed the first workshop on the story,
mm-hmm.
I had to open a blog, which a lot of people are not very aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a blog that was shrouded in a lot of secrecy,
mm-hmm.
because this blog came up and it was about a woman. I was pretending to be a woman who had gone through abuse.
Mm.
And I was like, this is my story. I will try and update this blog as, you know, as often as possible with things that have happened to me in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And funny, I won a lot of female fan base, you know, by that. A lot of women were interested to know what another woman had to say about, you know, her life and about abuse.
Yeah.
So each week I kept posting like a section of the novel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting tremendous, you know, responses from women.
Wow.
But 90% of them weren't convinced that I was a woman. They were not. That's the first draft. Many of them were not convinced. And that was my first lesson in writing as a woman.
Mm.
That a man's voice is, you know, different from a woman's voice, because they kept faulting my use of terms, words, constructions, not necessarily grammar. It was more like, a woman won't express herself in this term. A woman won't, you know, and I kept thinking, how else can I express
myself? They would actually say that. They will actually write
Yeah, they will. They would say that in the email. They're like, they're saying, so one was even blatant to, you know, she was so upfront when she said, I really doubt if you're a woman sometimes, because you come across as somebody trying to be a woman.
Mm.
You know? And so I had to go back and rewrite. I kept rewriting all those posts.
Right.
Until I get it right. And they were like, now you're a woman. This is how a woman would say it. Exactly.
Ah.
You know, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. You know? And there was a particular scene that I remembered when Erica, that's the lady, yeah, the lead lady in the novel, the protagonist,
yes,
first had a sexual intercourse with the man she came, you know, comes to meet in England.
Mm-hmm.
The man she eventually gets married to, the white guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like a rape. I wouldn't call it lovemaking, because the man had no regard for her as a woman. He just did what he had to do.
Right.
So the first draft of that was just very, you know, typical narrative as a man would express it.
And very technical, women, very clinical.
Yeah, they just faulted it. They were like, no, this is not how we think. This is even, my mind wouldn't go here.
Yes.
I wouldn't, you know.
Yes.
And then I went back and I rewrote that. And I had to read a lot. I was reading things like Virginia Woolf. I read Sophia Tarr. Yeah. I read Buchi Emeteta. All the female writers I knew that I respected.
Right.
And then I started having a sense of how women thought and how they wrote. I spoke to my mom as well.
Right.
You know, I spoke to my best friend who happens to be a female, and I kept querying and asking questions.
Right.
And then I rewrote that particular section of the novel and posted it on the blog.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was where I got the highest amount of posts, you know, everybody commenting on it.
Mm.
How, you know, precise it was, how it could have been me, it could have been me. Oh my God, you entered my head, this could have been me. And I was like, I think I cracked the code, I think I cracked it. You know, that's what I thought. So when the book was completed, after several drafts,
right,
I was introduced to an editor in the US who I'd never met before, but I checked her out and I was like, oh, this is pretty good. I sent her the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
And on my trip to the U.S. in 2006, I think, or 2007, I can't remember, 2006,
mm-hmm,
I thought I was going to be able to meet the editor, but I couldn't. So I dropped a voice message for her while I was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back to Nigeria, I got this long email from her. And to sum it up, what she said was that the first time I was introduced to you, I presumed you were a man because of your name, Jude.
Mm-hmm.
But then I read your manuscript,
oh,
and it
God
occurred to me that only a woman could have written this.
Oh,
and then I hear your voice on the telephone recording, and now I'm totally confused. Are you a man or a woman? I think that was the validation I was looking for.
I think that's incredible validation. You finally cracked the code of what women want, or who women are, how they think.
Yeah, that was great. That was really great for me. And I think that was the challenging part about writing that story, was writing it in that voice, not writing it as a third person, but writing it as a first person, like, this is me.
Yes.
This is what happened to me.
Yes.
And during the presentation as well, one of the, in Lagos, when the book was released, one of the journalists, male journalists, was like, okay, Mr. Dibia, what have you written again? Another gay novel?
You should have said, no, this time I'm a woman.
No, I didn't. I just said, why don't you read it and let me know? You know, I think I don't want to be predictable as a writer. I don't want people to say, okay, this is, he wrote one book that had to do with male sexuality, so all other books has to be about male sexuality.
Right.
And the second book now had to do with this. Does it mean, you know, I want people to just keep guessing, what's going to do next? What's he going to do next? What style is he going to be writing about? Or topics or whatever.
I think at this point they're just like, you know what? If it's Judibia, I'll read it, whatever it is, because it's gonna be good, you know. Because after the first one, okay, it's about homosexuality. Then the second one is where you're a male writer, but you're writing completely as a woman. I mean,
yeah.
At least me personally, the third one, I wouldn't even bother guessing. I'll be like, whatever it is. He doesn't even have to name it. I will buy it and I will read it. You know. Oh, that's such a wonderful story. And I think the fact that you created a blog to really run through the mills with the second novel, to really push it through and work at it, I think that was such a smart, incredibly smart thing to do. You know, and it
Thank
shows
you.
Your dedication as getting your dedication to getting your product right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, absolutely. So now I have to ask you, now that we've come, you know, full circle and you're a published writer, tell me what the earliest piece of writing that you can remember, a complete piece of writing that you did. It could have been a poem, it could have been a short story, it could have been anything.
Oh my God, it's so embarrassing to say.
That's exactly why I asked. That's exactly why I asked.
Okay, I have to admit that I had a thing for Enid Blyton and the Fame of Five series and the Secret Seven series as well.
Okay.
And my dad used to buy, like, every week, you know, he'll buy a new title or two.
Mm-hmm.
And I always looked forward to Saturday because I knew, okay, I'm going to get a new Fame of Five novel.
Yes.
And when I got, you know, bitten by the muse and I knew that I needed to write stories as well,
mm-hmm.
I believe my first story was like a Fame of Five book.
Mm-hmm.
It had to do with five brothers because we're five in my family, five boys.
Okay.
And there was a golden retriever as well.
Okay.
There was a haunted house,
yes.
And there was a creek, and there were lots of snakes. I can't remember the remaining details of the story, but I know it was a poor copy of Fame of Five.
Was it a short story? Was it a paragraph? How long was it?
No, it was a full exercise book.
Oh, it was a complete novel?
Yeah, like a novella type.
Wow. Oh, my God. Do you still have it?
No, I'm sure my mom will. She never throws anything away.
Okay. No. So right now you work for Virgin Atlantic as a project manager?
I work for the company that brought in Virgin Atlantic. It's called Aviation Logistics and Management Limited.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work with Virgin, but I later moved to Aviation Logistics full-time.
Okay.
And as a product development manager.
Okay. So you have a 9-to-5 and then you write in
yes,
your spare time.
Yes, I have a 9-to-5 and I write.
Wow. That's a very complete and very active life.
It's very difficult to.
Mm-hmm.
I find that I'm struggling to, you know, I love both the profession, but if I was to choose, obviously I would choose my writing.
Right.
It is hard. It is hard to have one life as this career person and then have this other life as a literary person where you write and everything. And, you know, the time, there's really no time.
Mm-hmm.
So my writing has to be done either very early in the morning between 6 and 8:30.
Okay.
I seldom write at night because I'm too knackered and tired by the time I get home.
Right.
Weekends, yes, I dedicate to some writing. And then I love television. I watch a lot of television. So, you know, it's juggling all of that and trying to, you know, write. It's difficult. I've just completed my manuscript for my third novel.
Mm-hmm.
And my editors and friends are asking me, my God, you're good. How come you, where do you find the time? Truth is, I don't know. It just happens.
Oh, okay. So can we get a glimpse of what the third novel is about and when we can expect it in bookstores?
The third novel will be out first quarter of next year.
Okay.
The title, the working title I have is called Blackbird, inspired by one of the Beatles songs,
mm-hmm.
Blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
It's different from my last two novels. It's a story that deals with four complicated characters, and it's intertwined. All the characters' lives are intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that also looks at displacement of people within their own society.
Right.
That's what I can say.
Oh, that's more than enough. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
We will absolutely look forward to it, and we'll be first in line to grab our copies. So right now, you've pretty much been writing, you know, if I got this right, from the earliest time, probably since high school or secondary school in Nigeria, mm-hmm. high school
yeah.
in the
States. Yeah.
So a span of probably something going on 20 years?
Yeah, I guess so. When I look back now, I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm old in this.
You are. But you know, if you count commercial success and actual being out there and being known as a writer, that would probably be in the last 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I think my shining moment came in 2005 with my first novel, basically because people were shocked and interested. And I was just happy that it was a book that people, you know, loved at the end of the day.
Right.
I remember being contacted by Professor Chris Dunton. He's the Dean of Faculty of Humanities at the University of Lesotho.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so impressed with the book that he recommended it, you know, at the university there.
Wow.
And while we did the second reprint of Walking with Shadows, he actually contributed a foreword to the novel, which was wonderful.
That's great.
I think I've just been known for about 4 years now, mm-hmm. 2005 to now, which is so funny. But when you look at it, I've been writing for quite a bit.
Yes. Oh, that's really a wonderful career span, I would say. So, what do you ultimately want to write about? Do you have, and maybe you don't, maybe you do, you have like a goal that ultimately if I could, if I had the wherewithal, the means, the time, the everything, this is my ultimate goal of what I would write, sit down, write and produce?
Now, that's difficult to say. I do want to have a body of work that, you know, people would probably find the link between or among them.
I'm sorry, people will what?
5 years ago. A body of work.
Mm-hmm. That people...
Yeah, that people would look at and say, okay, there is something that connects all this work together.
Okay.
It could be sexuality, it could be anything. I really can't tell. Right now, I just feel I'm still learning. I'm still reading and learning some new things. And ultimately, you know, I hope I just keep writing. It's difficult to say this is what I want to do, but I just want to keep telling good stories.
Okay.
Stories that will matter to people, stories mm-hmm. that people would find, you know, some sort of solace when they go to it and
okay.
find themselves, you know, portrayed realistically,
okay.
and, you know, feel a sense of pride as well
right.
when they read about themselves. And I want to tell Nigerian stories. I'm really fascinated by the Nigerian character
right.
and the fact that we can go through so many things and still survive and still have a smile on our faces. You know, that's amazing to me. So I think that's for now is my goal.
Okay, and that's definitely a lot, you know. So in terms of what you like to write most, do you actually go for the controversial stories, or you just pick the stories that matter? And sometimes they may be controversial.
It's funny about the way stories come to you are different. I could be sitting on a bus or on a plane or anywhere and catch, you know, a bit of a conversation and... it might inspire me to want to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
As for being controversial, I wouldn't say I deliberately want to be controversial, but I just find that writing these stories about conflicted characters is something I can do, you know, I enjoy doing.
Right.
I've had questions about my identity, my sexuality, myself, my origin, my, you know, that prompts me to also want to write stories like that as well.
Okay. So what do you not like to write about and why?
The most difficult thing to write about is myself.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. It really is myself. And even if you get to read my blog, you would find out that I focus on other things other than myself. I find it very difficult to write about myself.
I noticed.
I think that's the hardest thing to write about.
Well, but then writing about yourself in what context?
in every context, you know, my day-to-day life, my thoughts, my actions, my, you know, I just find that weird. I just feel uncomfortable, I think, about myself.
Okay, that's fair enough. I have read your blog, and yes, I noticed that you do not write about yourself, but you definitely write about enough interesting stories that, you know, they're good. So, what I know, you mentioned a few authors. You mentioned Zephietta, you mentioned other
Virginia Woolf, exactly. Toni Morrison, Butchie Machata.
Yes, and you know, that have influenced you, and especially on the women's side, taught you how to be a woman, even only in print. But generally, what is your inspiration, and who are your inspiration? And why?
I derive my inspiration, you know, mostly from life, just life itself.
Right.
But when it comes to my literary giants or people that I really respect, that I go to their work to look for, you know, inspiration, number one on the list would be Toni Morrison.
Right.
And then James Baldwin.
Yeah.
And there are tons of others, but these two are the first two you always see me talking about. Their work always, I don't know, once I read their words, I'm like, wow. You know, they're brilliant, really, really brilliant. And I hope that one day I can, you know, be able to write as good as they do.
Right. So, but in a sentence or a few short sentences, what inspires you? How does Toni Morrison write that inspires you? How does James Baldwin tell a story that inspires you?
Okay, Toni Morrison has a way with words and insights into a character's, you know, mind that is so acute that you can't but love her writing.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes with James Baldwin. He tackled issues of sexuality as far back as the 60s.
Right.
You know, he was a Black American man who had gone through a lot of issues himself, and if you read his work, it's like his works were written with his blood. There's so much passion there that, you know, I believe that's what writing is all about. It's not just telling stories. You must love writing.
Mm-hmm.
You must have the passion to tell stories, the passion to write them. And when I read their works, these two authors, I see that. I see the, you know, the craft, the dedication, the love for this, and totally moves me.
Okay. Yeah, that's definitely impressive. And it's really at the core of it, it's the love for writing and being able to let that shine through with words and storytelling.
Yeah.
Okay. Jude, we're going to move into your family and networks, and because we'd like to know what the structure around you is, and how that supports or even takes away from your creative process, if you will.
Okay.
So do you mind telling us about your family, your closest networks, and how they influence your work for better or for worse?
Family. I have mentioned my dad earlier.
Yes.
Bless him. And let me talk about my mom a bit.
Right, please.
I think growing up, and probably one of the reasons why I've been attracted to female characters in my writing, is I've always believed that women are far stronger than men are. And I always looked at my mother while I was growing up. This woman is so strong. Not strong in the sense of physical strength, but more from, you know, mental and the other kind of strengths that you can look for in a human being.
Right.
And I've always respected women for that. She worked like my dad worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was a teacher, but, you know, growing up with just boys, she had no girls to help her.
Right.
She would get us up in the morning, you know, get everybody prepared for school, make sure you have your breakfast, make sure you have lunch when you get back home. She dashes off to go shopping for whatever. She loved shopping anyway. comes back to make sure there's dinner. wakes up for my dad to get back from work, feeds him, makes sure she puts anybody to bed, locks up the house at the end of the day. You know, and meanwhile, my dad just goes to work and comes back and sleeps. And weekends, you know, seriously, weekends he takes us out to play tennis or to the country club or whatever.
Yeah.
And I kept looking, and, you know, she never complained. Yeah. I've never seen her complain.
Yeah.
She did it so well. She was so, you know, she was so strong in that way.
Uh-huh.
And every time I write female characters, I try to imbibe that kind of strength into them.
Right.
You know, because I do believe that they're very strong people.
Right.
You know, bringing up a family is not an easy thing. And in Africa especially, it's quite difficult.
Mm.
And, yeah.
Okay, so your mom influences your female characters, or the strength of your mother maybe influences all your characters.
Yeah, I think so. I actually think so. I mean, I do have sometimes I have issues with her, but, you know, I mean, they're parents. You always have issues with parents.
Absolutely.
And but then again, I love them to bits.
Oh, absolutely.
And then I have five brothers. I'm the second.
Mm-hmm.
And we all look alike. We all sound alike on the telephone. So.
Oh, really?
we're pretty close. Mm-hmm. And I think they've gotten to understand that I love writing, so they give me the space. We don't live together anymore. We all live differently and separately.
Uh-huh.
And I have two brothers out of the country, one in Australia, one here in London,
uh-huh.
And the three of us back home in Nigeria. We all lived, you know, apart.
Uh-huh.
We try to keep in contact once in a while on telephones and stuff like that, or have lunch together.
Uh-huh.
They encourage my writing. They're my biggest fans, you know.
Okay.
The last born is such a sweetheart. I remember when Unbridled came out,
mm-hmm.
he single-handedly sold about 100 copies.
Wow.
Yeah, he called me up and says, call your publisher, tell them to give me a couple of copies. I can sell them for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was kidding, so I called up my publishers and they sent me, you know, 100 copies, which I sent to his office.
Mm-hmm.
And within a week, I sold everything to friends and, you know. So they're my greatest fans. And I really, really, you know, appreciate that.
That's good. That's wonderful. So generally, what has been their reaction to your work?
Is it for my family or for my friends or generally?
Well, your closest networks, which will start with your family probably, and then, you know, the closest people.
Very supportive. You know, one would expect, you know, you expect that, but then again, I wrote a book that was not exactly orthodox. And, you know,
exactly, wasn't, I mean, you know.
Exactly.
Within the norm, it wasn't.
Was hard, yeah, it was hard to gauge how they were going to react to that at first.
Yes.
And my brothers, I have to admit that one of my brothers used to be very homophobic, very, you know, very, very homophobic. The kind of stuff he would say. You know, even while I was there, you know, not knowing that I was researching this to write a novel. So after I'd written Walking with Shadows and he read it, he actually changed. He had never uttered any kind of, you know, negative statement about gay people in front of me, at least that I know of.
Wow.
And that was wonderful to see him take that effort to change.
Wow.
How he thought.
Wow.
My dad was a bit like, okay. No, rather, my mom was, when I saw her after she read it, she's like, so why did you write about this? And I knew she grew up in the North, and I know that in Nigeria, the North has been known to have tons of gay people.
Okay.
And so I asked her, I was like, are you saying that gay people don't exist in Nigeria? She was like, of course they do. I grew up in the North, and that was her answer, but it never went beyond that, you know. My dad was like, okay. He never believed I was a writer until he came to one of my readings.
Mm.
Yeah, and he was in Lagos that day, and he came visiting, and my publisher was organizing a book, my first reading in Nigeria, that was in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to read from my two novels, and so I invited my dad,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, who's going to be there? I said, well, I don't know, people. You know, and he was mentioning other writers like Odiel Fiemu and some others. And luckily for me, Odiel Fiemu was at my book reading.
Oh,
and he's
good.
One of the people that loves my writing.
Oh, good.
So after the
validation,
event,
right?
You know, sorry?
Validation.
validation, you know? So after the event, I didn't get to see my dad because he wasn't staying with me.
Right.
But my kid brother that was taking him home now calls me on the phone. He was like, "My God, daddy is so proud." I said, "Why?" He said he couldn't just believe that you were surrounded by all these people who were discussing your work. And, you know, he said, he's so proud of you. And I was like, wow.
Oh, that is so sweet. Oh, that's so sweet. And to have a good supportive network that, in spite of the controversy of the topic, you know,
yeah,
it's still like, you know, it's almost like, you know, you introduce this topic and prior to them having this intimate knowledge of, you know, what happens to certain people in certain situations, you know, you have a preconceived view. And then you get to expand it and get to read this work that sort of opens your mind. But they were willing to, you know, have that experience. And I think that's a wonderful blessing to have.
Yeah, that's the word, blessing. I feel blessed. I feel that I'm one of those writers that live in, you know, that live full-time in Nigeria that have been blessed. My books sell well. My readers have really embraced my writing. Mm-hmm. They send me personal emails to congratulate me, to find out how I'm doing, to find out when my next book is going to be out, you know. Just having that support alone is overwhelming sometimes.
Oh, and it's with good reason, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I take it that this is for probably a far stretch, but your work is never directly about your family, at least not yet, and it hasn't caused any direct friction.
I think it would be more difficult. You know, there's one or two projects I've been working on, which chronicles, you know, family, and because my family is really interesting when I come to think about it. The other day I was just trying to remember a whole lot of my childhood, and you know, I told you earlier when we spoke once on the telephone that I have selective amnesia, which is true.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, my goodness, it would be nice to actually write something about a family almost identical to mine and the issues that they had trying to become a family and trying to, you know, love and support each other.
Right.
Because they have been struggles, they have been issues in the past, they have been trials and stuff like that. But, you know, and we're here today, and we're still one, and we're still so supportive of each other.
Right.
Such a wonderful story. I wouldn't write it as a real-life story. Of course, I'll color it up a bit, but, you know, I'll give myself some time.
To get to that level, to be able to do justice to it, you know, probably, right? So the last pill, actually, were we the first, was Halftribe.com the first place where you published the last pill?
You know, I'm actually quite grateful to Halftribe.com because a lot of people don't know me as a short story writer, and I'm not a short story writer. And sometimes I do doubt my own prowess when it comes to short storytelling. And so to be accepted by Halftribe, I was really quite thrilled. And afterwards, two other publications, print publications in Nigeria, you know, wanted to publish it after reading it off Halftribe.com. And that was quite, you know, splendid for me.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, we definitely loved the story when we got it. And like we said, we were in awe when we received it. And we're like, wow, of course we'll publish it. Are you kidding? So, but just to ask you a bit, what do you think about the state of publishing in Nigeria and Africa in general? And what are the opportunities or the challenges for young and budding writers?
I think it's very hard. First and foremost, there's no infrastructure to support publishing in any sense.
Right.
So that's the first thing that needs to be tackled.
Right.
And once that is tackled, then you have to think about the distribution.
Right.
And the cost of books itself.
Right.
What we had in the 80s or in the 70s or in the 60s, when we had the Achebes and the rest, where we have subsidized publishing, whereby it wasn't so expensive to publish, and you had great, you know, editors in the countries and great publishing houses.
Right.
In the 80s, with the military years, that was destroyed. And there's something that I read somewhere, and I've been hearing repeatedly for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hide something important from a black man, put it in a book.
Wow.
And I think a lot of our governments really tapped into that and tried to destroy the industry, you know, the publishing industry.
Mm.
And so what you have today is a whole lot of independent publishers trying their best, but then again, there's really no network to or distribution to get the book from point A to the reader's hands to point B to point C to point D.
Right.
So, but things are changing. There's some publishers out there.
Right.
A group of writers, some writers in different countries form collectives where they can tackle these issues.
Mm-hmm.
In Nigeria, I'm proud to say that I'm aware of a collective that's about to start very soon.
Mm-hmm.
Also looking at, you know, tackling that and producing fantastic literature. So I think it's on a positive side, a positive rise for us.
That's wonderful. And I think what we try to do at halftribe.com is to encourage that writing in people that, look, let's we'll get to the publishing aspect. Just let us,
let's learn how to write first.
Exactly. Yes, let's, you know, be creative and imaginative and everything. We'll put it on halftribe.com. Other people will see it. You get to meet published writers. You get to meet other new writers and people in the arts and entertainment world, and you learn about culture, and you learn to be proud of your culture, and then we'll take it from there. We'll all work together and be collaborative and build together.
Totally. I'm very proud of you guys, because I've gone through your site, halftribe.com, and in the pro section, there's some chapter, I can't remember the name now, who has posted a couple of chapters of a forthcoming novel I presume.
Right.
Yeah, and then things like that. And it's really good to have other people read your work and give you nice or accurate criticism and advice on how to make it better. And also give you a pat on the back if you're doing a good thing as well.
Exactly.
And there's very few avenues for African writers. So when you have things like halftribe.com and the other sites that support African writing,
yeah,
I think that's fantastic.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for the acknowledgement. We are working hard to please our people.
No problem.
Is there anything else you'd like to let us know about who is Jude Dibia, and, you know, that you'd like your audience to know, your readers to know?
Nothing. Apart from the fact that, you know, everybody knows me. I'm very private. I'm a very private person.
Right.
Happen to be a very shy person who writes.
Mm-hmm.
If I can, you know, if I can avoid the limelight, I will, but I can't. I've been very supportive of other younger writers coming up, and, you know, a lot of good writing is coming out of Nigeria, which is wonderful.
Right.
Since my first book came out, I've had other writers who want to tackle the same issue on, you know, issues on homosexuality,
mm-hmm,
you know, contact me and for support or for materials to use and things like that. So I've really been doing my own bits and helping a lot of younger writers, published and unpublished, which is a really fulfilling thing for me. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Still trying to look for another good story for you.
Good. Thank you. Yes. Yes. I mean, you sent us the last pill, and since then we're waiting. That, okay, come on, man. What's next? What's next?
I find it easier to tell very long prose than to do it in, you know, a short story form.
Wow.
Well, the short ones I do, I try to make it very meaningful.
And it was. I mean, you know, the last pill that we mentioned earlier in the interview was a short story about the controversial topic of HIV/AIDS.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
And how one deals with it, especially if you're dating.
Exactly.
You know, and how honest you need to be and with your partners, and. It like we said, it generated over 500 hits. The story was well done, well written, very concise, very to the point. There was suspense. There was, you know, it was like in that short story, you managed to have a cliffhanger.
Thanks.
You know, by the end of the
I really wanted people to think about it, especially the young ones, about sleeping around, and, you know, it's a very dangerous world we live in. And I didn't want to be didactic in my story. I just wanted to tell a story, and then you reflect afterwards, and you're like, oh, my God, she could have slept with him, and she had this,
and
he probably didn't have it, and, you know, all those questions.
But to be honest with you, you made it human. You humanized, and in a sense, you also romanticized it, because, you know, obviously, yes, this is someone that has this
disease,
and absolutely should be responsible, but the way you told it, at least for me, you made it seem like, yeah, but They're still human.
Yeah, but you know, because you know what? A lot of the other stories that you get to read about people with HIV and all that, it's always very sad, or that ends up in death.
Mm.
There's really there's no promise for life.
Yes, what there's I was no
trying
hope.
To also do, yeah, it's no hope.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was trying to do there was that, you know what, you can live if you live responsibly, regardless of if you have this thing.
Yes.
And that was the underlying message of that whole short story itself.
Yes, exactly. Yes, you didn't discard them. You didn't say, well, you have this, too bad, get out. You know, you were responsible, got it. No, you were like, no, this happened. However it happened, funny enough, you didn't even touch on that. You didn't even give us...
Yeah, because it's not necessary.
Yes.
You know, because if you have that, I'm sure you must have tortured yourself for...
Already, yes.
You know, weeks, years already saying, how could I, who did this to me?
That's
but you know
true.
What? Truth is, you need to take responsibility and realize that you did it to yourself.
That's
true. So the how wasn't really important. But the fact that you have hope
mm-hmm.
and that you can live a normal life, kind of,
mm-hmm.
is important to me.
Yes, yes. And you managed to convey that quite excellently, we must say.
Thank you very much.
So as a closing, in closing, in one or two sentences, what is the one thing you know for sure now?
What's the one thing I know for sure now? That life is too short, and we really have a very limited amount of time to make an impact in this world. And in the short time that we have, we must do something positive to, you know, impact on other people around us.
That's really good. That's very inspiring. Well, thank you so much, Judibia, for granting us this interview. We here at halftribe.com are so grateful.
Thank you so much, Oye.